Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. Our topic is once again Iraq.
So many people predicted that what has very tragically happened would happen. And I think that raises real issues of responsibility.
It's very clear to people that the U.S. is committing war crime after war crime in Iraq and totally disregarding the Geneva Conventions and making just gross violations of international law on a daily basis.
We talk with U.S. journalist Dar Jamail and attorney and international law expert Philippe Sands of the U.K. this time. Philippe Sands is a professor of international law at University College of London and the founding member of the Matrix Law Office. In his book, A Lawless World, Sands reveals that the President of the United States was certain that war against Iraq was inevitable, and he said he expected the Iraqis to fold easily. A New York Times story about the Sands book by Don Vannetta Jr. has created a sensation in America. It describes the contents of a memo Sands obtained that recounts a meeting in the Oval Office January 31, 2003, between President George Bush and UK Prime Minister Tony Blair. They spoke about invading Iraq, regardless of a supporting UN vote. George Bush made suggestions about how to market and prosecute the war, too. He suggested having an Iraqi defector give a public presentation about Hussein's WMDs, or that the U.S. fly U-2 reconnaissance aircraft over Iraq that had been painted in UN colors so that Hussein might fire on them and find himself in breach. George Bush also discussed assassinating Saddam Hussein. As this story begins to gain attention in America, two things are clear to international law expert Philippe Sands. One is that the U.S. violated international law by invading Iraq. The other is that no one seems to be taking responsibility for the disaster this has created. Professor Philippe Sands, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Hi, very pleased to be with you.
Now, there has been quite a commotion caused by the latest article about the memos that appeared in your book, Lawless World. Just talk about the response thus far to the New York Times story.
Well, it's been interesting. Obviously, this is a story that broke in the UK a couple of months ago, so we've had some time to get used to it. The news media, the political elites in the United States seem to be rather slower than their British counterparts in getting up to speed on these issues. But with the New York Times piece, obviously, interest has increased fairly dramatically. I mean, this is the first interview I've given, but they've lined up, starting with you, all the way up to some of the other characters on CNN and ABC and NBC and all of that. So somehow the dam has burst and the issue has opened up.
Well, we're very pleased to be able to talk with you here on Talk Nation. First, do you believe that George Bush and or Tony Blair have violated international laws, and talk about that in the way they determined to go to war in Iraq? What are some of the basic details of such an argument?
Well, they violated international law by using force contrary to the established rules of international law. I should say at the outset, these are rules that the United States itself put in place, and the U.S. has been a global leader and a force for good on international rules, so there's some considerable concern here in the UK in particular as to what's happening. Why did they break international law? Well, basically, you can use force in two circumstances. Either self-defense, if your country is attacked or is about to be attacked. That didn't happen in this case. The other alternative is if the Security Council, the UN body, authorizes the use of force. That didn't happen, and so there was no justification for the use of force. So, yes, the war was unlawful, and these two esteemed leaders have taken their countries into an illegal path.
Now, you were the first one to publish these memos and release them really into the public. And I want to talk about the reaction in terms of the official reaction to that just briefly here. Did what you published cause you any difficulty?
None whatsoever. I mean, Britain is a country in which free speech is powerfully ingrained. There are criminal laws which limit people's ability to make use of certain types of material, and I've exercised very great caution and care in making sure that, particularly being a lawyer, that I'm fully within all of the rules. So I'm delighted to say I've had no difficulties, so to speak, and I've had considerable support from rather strange quarters.
Now, one of the things that struck me about the New York Times piece is the depth of involvement, really, on the part of both Bush and Blair in the details of this attack on Iraq that was planned and even scheduled, you know, specifically talking about destroying oil wells where, you know, there might be concern about how they could be repaired quickly and mentioning specifics about the north and south of the country. Just talk about that briefly.
Well, as the New York Times has reported it, they've certainly gone into considerable detail. But I think you would expect that. I think we'd be pretty concerned if our political leaders took decisions of such significance without going into the detail. I think what's of greater concern is not that they went into detail, but they did so with such staggering incompetence. When one reads that President Bush believed there would be no internecine strife, no insurgency, so to speak, and does so contrary to all the advice we know that the people in the State Department were giving him and the people in the Foreign Office were giving Tony Blair, that, I think, is pretty staggering. So many people predicted that what has very tragically happened would happen. And I think that raises real issues of responsibility.
Now, there has not been a tendency to take that responsibility, either on the part of Tony Blair in England or George Bush in the U.S. And in fact, instead, what we're seeing in America is a sort of war on bad press. And we see a great effort in terms of the war in Iraq and at home here to combat criticism. So there's not a real direction that we're moving in here toward either repairing the policy, fixing things in Iraq, or making things right in the countries where these laws may have been violated.
Well, I wonder if the tide has begun to turn. I think the situation, it's a really powerful point that you've made, and I think the situation is different in Britain and in the United States. I mean, in Britain there has been a vibrant debate for the last 3 years, and these issues are aired in the mainstream media on a weekly, if not daily, basis. And the Prime Minister plainly has suffered a very great loss of authority. And in fact, the question of the legality of the war and the war itself was the dominant issue in the last British general election and came very close to unseating Tony Blair. But the fact is he was re-elected, although with a very much smaller majority. In the US, and I spend a lot of time in the US, my wife's a New Yorker, my kids are all New Yorkers, so I'm pretty, you know, connected with what's going on there. The story's been completely different. And for reasons that I've not yet fully understood, the president in particular has been given an awful lot of slack to get on with things on the idea that somehow if you criticize, you're against him. And that I think, is a big difference between the two cultures. But I think something has now changed in the United States, and I'm struck at the level of interest now and the fact that finally newspapers like the New York Times are beginning to get into these issues indicates a change of direction.
And the tendency, though, in Congress is to either pass laws that will make what has already happened legal, as in the case of the NSA spy program being discussed here, or in some way legitimize the war in terms of what is needed in Iraq today. And so there has not been review of the laws that may have been violated and of what should happen as a consequence.
No, that seems like a very fair point. And I think that probably goes to issues of legal culture. I mean, it's been a matter of considerable surprise to me that there has been no opposition in the United States, either in the media or, shall we say, amongst the Democrats. In Britain, Tony Blair did have a principled opposition, which gave him considerable grief, and there was a media outlet in the mainstream in which to raise a lot of these issues. In the U.S., that hasn't happened, and I noticed that even today, the Democrats seem to be having terrible difficulty rallying around Senator Feingold's suggestion that there should be some sort of reprimand or censure for the president on actions which plainly violate, as I understand it, U.S. laws in terms of the spying on U.S. nationals. So something curious and worrisome is taking place.
And let's just say that you are the founder of Matrix Law Office in London. You have some very well-known people in that practice. Sherry Blair, in fact, the Prime Minister's wife, a partner.
She is indeed a colleague of mine. We're both barristers in the same chambers. We're close colleagues, and I respect her, and she respects me. And I think it's a mark of British society that we can express views and remain collegial and friendly. But obviously, you know, she and I may look at things in different ways, and we will, you know, beat our particular paths.
Now, there was talk of Tony Blair possibly resigning. Do you get a sense that that's the direction things are moving in England?
Well, I mean, he's announced, and he took the decision himself, that he would not stand for re-election. So it's pretty clear he's in the home straight. Whether that home straight lasts, you know, another month or another year or another 3 years is completely unclear. But he's plainly been wearied by what has happened. And the legacy, many people feel, of the Blair administration, rather tragically, will be Iraq. I mean, he is the prime minister of a government that has done many very good things, many of which I've supported, including the use of force, I have to say, in places like Kosovo and Afghanistan. But the Iraq issue was one that people just don't understand why he went with President Bush. It was plainly a failure of judgment. It was plainly a failure of statesmanship. And it has left an indelible mark, it seems.
Professor Philippe Sands, thanks so much for taking our call.
Thank you very much for having me.
Philippe Sands is a professor of international law at University College of London and the founding member of the Matrix Law Office of London. His book, A Lawless World, America and the Making and Breaking of Global Rules, is described in a March 27th story by Don Bannata Jr. in the New York Times. The book is available at Amazon.com. We speak with U.S. journalist Dar Jamail for a continued conversation about events in Iraq, U.S. war crimes, media coverage, and where U.S. policy is heading in Southwest Asia as Congress and the American people are struggling through issues of presidential powers. During his 8 months in Iraq, Dar Jamail wrote about mass arrests and then mass graves in Fallujah, which the U.S. military had designated as a free fire zone. He has been touring the U.S. with several films about Iraq that are available on his website, darjamailiraq.com. While many Americans view the invasion and occupation of Iraq as a disaster right now, those who are familiar with the region are also concerned about the institutionalization of the way the war on terror is being prosecuted there. Political scholar and author Michael Parenti and journalist Greg Pallast have argued that in some ways the Iraq war is not a failure. They cite larger goals of the Bush and Blair governments. And Dar Jamail also argues here that the policies laid out in documents like the Project for a New American Century are continuing. As to the responsibility of coalition forces and the Bush and Blair governments, Jamail is very clear. He has testified on evidence of war crimes in Fallujah at a mock war crimes tribunal held on BBC television. The show was called The Allies on Trial, and an audience and mock jury found the Allies guilty. I asked Dar Jamail to start out by giving us an overview of what is happening in Iraq.
The situation is so out of control that it's even far worse than the Lebanese Civil War, which, just to give you a rough idea of Lebanon during that time period. It's such a tiny, tiny country, yet at one point there were at least 23 different warring factions. Well, Iraq is basically that on steroids. We have, we don't even know how many warring factions there are, even just in the Iraqi resistance alone. Even the CIA estimates there could be up to 100 different resistance groups. That's not even talking about militias in the country, operatives from foreign countries, including from the U.S.-led coalition. So it's to say it's a quagmire and a mess is really understating it at this point. I don't think it's we could really even fathom a much more complex, bloody, chaotic situation on the ground there.
The administration is using massive amounts of taxpayer money to improve its image in reaction to some of these negative stories. And according to Representative Waxman's office, the Bush White House has spent some $1.6 billion on advertising and PR. That's over the past 2.5 years. Waxman assumes it's going to be something like $1 billion per year in his reports. Now, on March 27th, NPR began running a series on the PR work of Karen Hughes, Undersecretary of State for Public Policy. Karen Hughes is directing a rapid response center where a staff essentially monitors bad press and then puts together talking points for officials who have to respond to questions about it. I want to listen to part of a report that Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne put together. And Dar Jamail, I'd like you to notice in particular that the Rapid Response Center team makes a comment at the very end of this section on the White Phosphorus story.
If this sounds a little like the war room in a presidential campaign, that may be no accident. The center was started by Karen Hughes, the former communications advisor to President Bush. Now she's the new top State Department official for what's called public diplomacy.
We do not target civilians. Any loss of civilian lives is regrettable.
She assigned a career diplomat named Duncan McGinnis to set up this office, sending information to top officials and to every U.S. embassy around the world.
The ambassador, for instance, in Cairo now has something. He's aware of this, so when he goes out today and then he talks to Egyptians publicly and otherwise, he can actually say, let me reiterate that we don't target civilians, blah, blah, blah.
And might the ambassador in Cairo then be getting back to you through his staff by tomorrow to say, what you gave me to say was useless?
They
it's
do.
Really inadequate
they
to
do.
The anger over this?
They will say that. We had a problem when we had the secret prisons in Europe.
At first, the State Department had almost nothing to say about a Washington Post story that the U.S. was holding detainees overseas. On this story, the department again has limited information about how civilians were really killed in Haditha, Iraq. So as Duncan McGinnis types, a colleague hands him a printout of words that were used after another story.
That's what we had for a kind of a white phosphorus.
Oh, here we go. That's good. I like it. The loss of any innocent life is a tragedy.
Dar Jamail, your response to this NPR clip about Karen Hughes and the Rapid Response Center.
I hope that everyone who heard that clip and hear how these people are operating are quite shocked and disgusted that really here we have very clearly evidence of members of the Bush administration and things that they have set up and are controlling that, you know, I mean, listen to this clip. Do you really feel that these people have any empathy whatsoever for Iraqi civilians who are being killed or being hit by white phosphorus? No, they're more concerned about how can we spin this atrocity to where it makes the U.S. look a little bit better or not quite as bad. It's all about them finding the right words. It's all about them manipulating the media and trying to cover the tracks of this disastrous occupation of Iraq. And the fact is that the tremendous suffering and death that it's causing to the Iraqi civilian population. These people are not concerned about true freedom and liberation and betterment of the lives of the average Iraqi people. They're concerned about covering the tracks of the Bush administration, covering up the mistakes, trying to spin it in the right way, which spin is a nice politically correct word for lies. Because the bottom line, this is an absolute travesty what's happening in Iraq. And these people, what we just heard that clip of, are essentially aiding and abetting in war crimes.
Now, Dar, there's also the fact that the crimes themselves, the atrocities that are being described, are not really clearly attributed to anyone. And so white phosphorus, no one really is getting the fact that this is U.S.-made white phosphorus and the U.S. happened to use it, right?
Well, without a doubt. I mean, I was actually the reporter that initially broke the story that incendiary weapons were being used by the U.S. military during the second siege of Fallujah, and that came out, and it was actually then later reported once that Rai television documentary was released in Italy this past winter, in late October, early November, and the Independent in the U.K. wrote about it. I wrote a short piece for them as well, and this essentially became common knowledge around Europe, even Western European countries, that the U.S. was using illegal and banned weapons in Fallujah as well as other places around Iraq. So of course, is all violations of international law, but, you know, it's again, outside of the U.S., it's very clear to people that the U.S. is committing war crime after war crime in Iraq and totally disregarding the Geneva Conventions and making just gross violations of international law on a daily basis. But people back here, the average person listening to bits and snippets of news on a daily basis when they come home in their car or come home from a long day on the job are, of course, not going to get this information.
Dar, let's take a look at your story from early March, March 3rd, about what John Negroponte, the National Intelligence Director, said about civil war in Iraq. Negroponte, according to you, saying this would be a serious setback to the global war on terror. Now, Dar, you're pointing out that he was not addressing the crisis in Iraq where civil war is concerned and the impact on civilians there. He was just talking about the war on terror.
That's right. You know, it's an interesting thing with John Negroponte where he's really not so directly involved with the situation in Iraq because he's already been brought in there to set up death squads, which he did. And maybe in just a minute we can talk a little bit more about his history regarding that policy. But, you know, his primary concern is instituting this global hegemony, military U.S. hegemony, particularly in the Middle East right now, about setting up bases and establishing a permanent presence for the U.S. military there. And so when he says that there's been a quote-unquote serious setback, most people listening to him would think, well, he's referencing Iraqi civilian casualties or civil war would be a serious setback. But no, in reality, he's referencing a more grand strategy of establishing a permanent presence there and then furthering U.S. military adventures in the Middle East.
Dar, just talk about the meaning of who he was saying this to at the Senate Armed Services Committee and on that day talking about planning for the war on terror.
Again, he's talking to high-ranking people in the U.S. Senate and other high-ranking Bush administration officials. And he's mentioning serious setback in regards to not just civil war, but anything else that might happen on the ground there or politically back here that would endanger these plans of establishing this permanent presence there, as well as tactics that are being used on the ground right now to further that policy that we're seeing played out on the ground in Iraq right now.
Now, turning again to John Negroponte, you were speaking of his history and the relevance of that history in light of the fact that we're seeing death squad activity in Iraq on an ongoing basis, an increasing number of bodies turning up, and the U.S. press here and there attributing the deaths to Shiite militia. Just talk about the meaning and implication of John Negroponte in the history of the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
It's important when we talk about John Negroponte for people to remember his place in the Reagan administration. He was the U.S. ambassador to Honduras from 1980 to 1984 during the Reagan involvement in Central America, and he is personally responsible for setting up death squads which operated in Honduras and in effect killed tens of thousands of civilians and militants in Honduras at that time. So it's no coincidence that he was brought over to Iraq. He was appointed U.S. ambassador at the so-called transfer of sovereignty the day Paul Bremer left on June 28, 2004, was the day John Negroponte took the reins as U.S. ambassador, a post that he held for roughly a year. And then fast forward to January 05, I was in Baghdad at that time as well. Negroponte was still the ambassador. And that was the time when, if you recall, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was talking about the quote-unquote Salvador option. So he was talking about, even publicly, he later ended up denying the use of this, but that's when he was talking about basically instituting death squads to try to combat the resistance in Iraq, which was growing rapidly out of control at that point after the failed second siege of Fallujah. And Negroponte, not so coincidentally, was the U.S. ambassador, and we had already been getting reports in Baghdad in different areas of death squads, which were comprised primarily of members of the Shia Badr Army, one of the more powerful Shia militias in Iraq, that these death squads were going around taking out, assassinating members of the resistance, Sunni imams, and also members of Muqtada al-Sadr's militia. They were taking out people who were in charge of different units of that militia as well. So these stories were coming out for at least a couple of months prior to January 05. And again, that's, Negroponte came in, set these things up, and now we see, fast forward from January 05 to late March 06, that these death squads have gotten completely out of control. It's tit-for-tat killings daily. On average, 40 bodies a day are turning up as a direct result of Negroponte's death squads in Iraq.
And, of course, now we're seeing even more confusion and strife between the various Sunni leaders, the various Shiite leaders, and any Americans who happen to be in touch with them, as events on the ground seem to suggest that America is either swapping sides or confused about which side it is on at any given time, as it tries to struggle through some way to stop the violence and at the same time get what it wants.
Well, I think you describe it very well. I think that's exactly what's happening, where we've seen the U.S. change sides dramatically a couple of different times so far in the occupation, and they're doing it again right now. I think it's, likening the U.S. and Iraq to someone who's drowning in a pool is not too far off of an analogy, because they're literally grasping at anything in their immediate sight that can give them some kind of leverage or some kind of leg up on the situation, because keep in mind the backdrop for this is that this is a 100% failed occupation. It's a complete disaster. The country is in total disarray and chaos. It's getting worse by the day, as we're seeing right now. And so the U.S., now they're leaning more towards secular Shia and even Sunni, whereas less than a few months ago they were all about supporting the Shia. Now they're trying to change the Shia prime minister of Iraq, leaning on the Shia very heavily to do this. This is coming out even just today. So, again, they'll switch sides to whoever might cooperate with them the best at that current moment, and I think this is something that we should get used to seeing on a regular basis, because the U.S. right now in Iraq is grasping for straws.
Let's take a look at the direction of the policy in Iraq. According to AP, U.S. General Peter Pace, who heads the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has said the U.S. underestimated the reluctance of the Iraqi people to form a government. The U.S. has been expressing increasing dissatisfaction with Jafari, the newly elected leader of Iraq, and there's an increase in blaming, with General Pace arguing that the Iraqis were slow to form a government because people were afraid after decades of Hussein's rule. Also, General Pace has spoken about the long war, an indefinite war on terror, and a Washington Post story by William M. Arkin states that the U.S. military has developed a 10-year plan for deep storage of munitions and equipment in at least six countries in the Middle East and Central Asia to prepare for regional war contingencies. Dar, does it seem to you that we may be looking at wider war regardless of what's going wrong with U.S. occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Absolutely it does, and I think that shows the absolute lunacy of this administration and people like General Peter Pace, who's become the favored neocon spokesman and propagandist, who says things also like recently on Meet the Press at the beginning of this month, he told Tim Russert, when asked how things were going in Iraq, he said, "Well, I wouldn't put a great big smiley face on it, but I'd say things are going very, very well in basically every aspect you can look at," and I paraphrase. But, you know, this is an individual that, you know, up there, he's up there with Rumsfeld as far as the shocking lies that he can tell on just a regular basis and even keep a straight face. Obviously this is an individual that should be removed from this position immediately, either because, A, it's very clear that they're sociopathic liars, or B, they're so deluded that they should probably be given a drug test. It's really astounding to me that these people keep parading around mainstream media and journalists keep letting them get away with these outlandish remarks. But it's very, very clear that this U.S. policy, not just Iraq, but in the entire Middle East, is moving forward. And I cite U.S. military documents to back this up. Just last month, the Quadrennial Defense Review Report talks about the U.S. military plans for fighting, quote, multiple overlapping wars, end quote. We have that now with Afghanistan, Iraq, and now designs on Iran/Syria. And I don't think they're going to stop. And then if we look at Joint Vision 2020, another military document, they talk about full-spectrum dominance of the U.S. military. They want U.S. military hegemony around the globe, and these plans are laid out there on paper. I mean, it's right there. Anyone can look it up right now on the Internet, and that on top of what was laid out a long time ago in the Project for the New American Century, that's another thing you can look up very easily. It's all right there. Go to the Middle East section, and it talks about securing Persian Gulf oil, Middle East oil, controlling those resources, and of course it talks about taking out the Iraqi regime, and it also mentions Iran. So it's all right there, and they're moving. I wouldn't say as scheduled, because the Iraqi resistance has slowed things up a bit, but I would be very surprised if we don't see military action in the form of a massive aerial bombardment taken against Iran before this administration leaves office.
Dar Jamil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Dori.
Dar Jamil writes for media outlets like The Nation, Interpress News, Truth Out, Alternet, and Asia Times. His stories on weapons used in Fallujah and Fallujah's refugees were selected for the book Censored 2006, the top 25 censored stories. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. Talk Nation Radio is produced at WHUS in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNation.org for transcripts and discussions. Our music is by Fritz Heed. FritzHeed.com.